So clearly, the games we play say a lot about us. So what does it mean that one of the most popular games in the world right now is Catan, the game where players compete to build settlements on a mythic island? Eric Thurm discovered it in college. He and his roommates never looked back.
My roommates a few years ago had ordered this lantern. And for a while, we would play Settlers of Catan. And every time we did, we would turn off all the lights and set up this lantern, and it would be the only light in the room. And someone would play probably the Lord of the Rings soundtrack. Maybe something else that sort of gives the sense that there are, like, hobbits in the area somewhere. The board setup is very heavily ritualized, and at various points, I would read passages from the Settlers of Catan historical novel. The characters all have names like Candemir and Osmond, and occasionally the paragraphs would be like, Candemir was afraid of the woman because he thought she might be a witch. And that creates the environment in which you are most willing to be swept along by the game. Everyone was maybe not in the best state to make game time decisions, which is maybe a polite way of saying that everyone was kind of drunk. There would just sort of be a lot of arguments about trading, and it becomes very serious. I sort of have gotten a little bit past that. Maybe not that much past it, but a little bit past it.
Portrait of a Board Game Geek. Eric Thurm is a writer and cultural critic. He does his best to keep up with the expanding global board games market. Did you know that, like, 5,000 new games are introduced every year? Somehow, he also found time to write a book in which he makes the case that games carry subliminal messages and are a lot more political than we think. He stopped by the studio to show me.
This one's got a lot of little pieces and some cards.
This is actually one of my favorite parts. Setting up a board game. It's very ritualistic.
Yes.
You write about players entering the magic circle. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
A little bit, yeah. The magic circle as a concept has been really helpful in terms of explaining to people who are interested in board games but don't necessarily think about them that much the type of interaction that you're being expected to have. When you're quote-unquote in the magic circle, everyone is agreeing to the rules of the game. We're not literally buying and selling properties, but everyone has just sort of decided to suspend disbelief and engage with each other.
One of the things I love so much about your book is that you start with this idea that board games communicate ideas. How did you even begin to think like that about board games?
I think that the first place that I thought about it was when I sort of learned about this Nazi propaganda game, Judenrausch. I stumbled upon this Wikipedia page called Nazi Board Games, and I vaguely remember yelling to whoever was in my house at the time that they needed to come read this thing over my shoulder. It just never occurred to me that that could exist.
Judenrausch.
Yeah.
Jews get out.
Yeah, and I did some research about it. Essentially, the way that it works is you are in a city that is not named but is ostensibly Berlin, and you go around and find these spaces on the board that are marked as shops or houses or places where, like, Jewish families live. And then you take these pieces that look like hats that in the original version have these very sort of anti-Semitic caricatures painted on them. You pick them up and then you go back to your collection point, drop off the family, and then they ostensibly are going to get deported to Palestine.
So you're going around as a player. Like,
yeah,
imagine this little Aryan kid. They're going around basically plucking up Jews.
Yes.
And for that, they get points.
The winner is the first person who, I think it's five, but I could be wrong about that. It's between four and six, I believe.
You actually wound up tracking it down.
Yeah, so there are two copies of it in the world, one of which is at Yad Vashem, and the other one is at the Wiener Holocaust Library in London. And I basically just asked them to send me a scan of the board and then had it printed at a print shop near my house, and then had a friend of mine who speaks German translate the rules.
So you actually wanted to play it?
I did play it. I had a bunch of my Jewish friends came over and we had a Shabbat dinner and then we played this game on Shabbos.
You played Judenreis on Shabbos. Okay.
And that was the whole point, was that we were going to talk about it and sort of have this conversation. What does it feel like to play this now? Does it raise any questions for us? The mechanic is really similar to any other standard board game that you would play. The thing that's different is just that the board looks different and the thing it's telling you to do is a little bit different.
But fundamentally, it's not that different than, say, Candyland.
Right, exactly. I spent a lot of time thinking about that, that especially when you're a child, you just will interact with whatever's put in front of you. You just will play because it's what you have available.
Right.
You don't really think about the story that it's telling you.
Yeah.
The conversation that we ended up having was really interesting because you start playing it and it feels terrible. And then because all you're really doing is rolling and moving your pieces, within 10, 15 minutes, you just forget that the thing that you're doing is just like going around and picking up Jewish families. I'm just kind of playing this game.
And so that's the creepiest thing you've said yet about it, that it can normalize it.
Right, exactly. A couple of my friends said, I don't think this would have been very successful as propaganda because it's a bad game. And other people said what you just said, which is that it is scarier in some ways that the game makes the act of rounding up these families boring and sort of very banal and something that you would do over the course of an evening's family entertainment.
Does anybody know whether Aryan kids really did play Judenreis? Like, were how many games were made or bought?
The most common number cited, and the one that I saw the first time I read about it, was that it sold 1 million copies.
Oh, my God.
But there are people who have studied it and think that maybe those two copies are the only ones that exist and that they were made as prototypes. I think that from my perspective, it doesn't actually matter that much. I think the thing that matters is just that it just is a pretty standard board game that was capitalizing on something that was really trendy at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that happened to be really trendy was anti-Semitism.
Well, so this is a really good introduction to thinking about games as a form of propaganda. That's a really overt example. But you write quite a bit about how games train us to think from inside their rules, which I don't completely understand.
Yeah. So especially in sort of basic competitive games, the point of the game is to win, and you sort of get trained to do what the game expects you to do in order to win. So let's say you're talking about Monopoly. The point of Monopoly is to get the most money. If you play a lot of Monopoly, the best way to play the game is to be really ruthless and take other people's properties, to do a lot of really aggressive trading, to undermine people, to be really vicious.
Which that's why I hate that game.
Well, it's why a lot of people hate that game, and it's a reason why I like cooperative games so much. So I talk a little bit in the book about this game, The Grizzled. That is That's right here. It's a cooperative game about World War I. Every character in the game is a member of this unit, and you don't win battles. You're surviving, and there is snow and hail and gas attacks and all these terrible things. And the point of the game is really just that you and the other players are sharing the burden of existing.
So wait, here, show me.
Sure.
Here.
The point of the game is to get rid of all of the cards, and the cards have what are called threats on them.
So let's show me one.
Okay, so this one has two threats on it. One of them is the shell, and one of them is knight.
Mm.
I could also play this that has snow and a shell.
And a rocket shell. If those show up, what do?
The way that you successfully complete rounds is by retreating and by stopping the mission, which you do by putting down a token that says, I want to lend support to one of the other players. And at the end of every round, when everyone has withdrawn, you look and see who has gotten the most support, and that person gets a very, very small bonus from the game.
This is like an anti-war game.
Yes,
I mean,
it
if you think about it compared to, I don't know, Axis and Allies, the goal isn't to win, the goal is to survive.
Yes, exactly.
I see what you mean. It's so different from Monopoly, where you're just trying to screw everybody else.
Yeah, it's really, really different. And I think it does a really fantastic job of taking the thing that it's about and making it the rules of the game.
Mm-hmm.
The point of the game and the way that you play it is by thinking about the theme of, can friendship be stronger than war? And the answer is often no, because it's very hard. But I think that's also part of what's good about it. It's difficult.
Yeah. So what's this one?
This is Class Struggle. It sort of was marketed as the world's first socialist board game. It was created and published in 1978 by Bertell Ullman, who at the time was a political science professor at NYU and still is a political science professor at NYU. And he encountered the early history of Monopoly and thought, why isn't there a game that teaches people about why either monopolies are bad or about what it would look like to really engage in this kind of struggle?
Because, like this, it says, class struggle to prepare for life in capitalist America.
Yeah.
And a picture of Karl Marx engaging in
arm wrestling. With Norman Rockefeller.
Okay, so we've got the board game out. One side says socialism, workers win, and the other is barbarism, capitalist win. Just so we know where we are.
Yeah. So there's a die here that has all of the classes on it.
Uh-huh.
And the way that you start playing is by rolling the class die and simulating the genetic lottery, because you don't get to decide what class you're born into.
Yeah.
I rolled the capitalists. So I didn't get to choose this. I just am the capitalists.
Oh, what's
that? That's the farmers. The farmers are part of the workers.
Okay. Then what?
But the capitalists also ostensibly get to decide what order the game goes in, who serves as banker. The capitalists get a lot of
power. Why do they get to decide?
Because they're the capitalists.
That's not fair.
Exactly. I think he would say that's the whole point of the game. And I think the capitalists also get to go first. 2, 3, 4, 5. So I got a chance card. Let's see which capitalist chance card I'm going to draw. So this one says, farmers are fooled into blaming consumers instead of the profits of capitalist middlemen for the low prices they get for their crops. Move directly to the next space that allows an alliance with the farmer class. Oh, it would be this one. Now it's your turn.
I was going to say, is it my turn yet?
Yes, it's your turn. Okay.
Three.
State regulatory commissions controlled by capitalists. Capitalists get two assets.
Well, you're just raking in the assets and I have nothing.
Well, I'm a capitalist. I started and I own the means of production. And
well, the game is rigged.
It is rigged. But that, he would say that's the game is just rigged.
Okay, look, I rolled doubles.
Oh, this is a fun one. Your boss died, but the new one acts in much the same way. You begin to understand the problem is not a mean boss, but the class of bosses. Two assets.
That's a life lesson. What are the chance cards for the capitalists?
Let's see. Coal mine disaster caused by absence of safety equipment that you refused to put in because, you said, it was too expensive. Send roses to the funeral and move back three spaces until the public outcry blows over.
Jesus. That's awful.
Or this is a fun one, too. You get caught with your hands in the public's pocket. They're in deeper than usual. In an attempt to whitewash your reputation, you set up a charitable foundation, tax-exempt and named after your family, but are forced to make a public announcement of your assets and debits.
Oh my God, this is all sitting a little too close to home.
Right, and a lot of this is very blunt, but also I think that a lot of it is pretty accurate and still pretty accurate in a lot of ways, and also just very funny in a way that makes communicating a lot of ideas that are often treated as very stuffy really accessible, because it's all done sort of through jokes.
I think what you're saying is we should have game literacy in the same way that we have media literacy. Just like if you're going to play a game, spend some time thinking about what it's actually teaching you.
I think it's complicated. I think if you think that the game having an idea or a message is inherently sort of nefarious, then it becomes very depressing. Which it is in some ways, but also that you can just say, okay, what kinds of games do we want to be playing? And I also think it's okay to say there should be more games that have propaganda for sort of my preferred ideology. There definitely are games that have ideas that I think are good. And the fact that a game is propaganda or has ideas, I don't think is a reason to not play it.
When he's not playing board games, Eric Thurm is a writer. His book, Board Games, is part of the Avidly Reads series.